Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today I'm having a conversation with Aubrey de Grey. Aubrey, I would like to begin with a question that I love asking. Where and when were you 18 years old?
I was 18 in 1981, and actually it was a rather uninteresting year for me because I was living in London. I had just finished my high school, and I was still about a year and a half away from going to university. I had an unusually long interval between high school and university because I took a second attempt to get into Cambridge University, which is where I went in the end.
Yeah.
So actually, when I was 18, I was actually working in a factory that made ice cubes, which was a business run by a neighbor of mine. And I was just doing this in order to get a feel for what work actually is.
What was going through the mind? What was your maturity level and your interest and your curiosity? Historically, I'm 71, so I was born in 1948. I was 18 in 1966 here in the United States in Texas, which was way behind as far as consciousness and intellect, as far as what I was able to experience. Who was Aubrey de Grey at 18? What were your interests? What was your perspective, your maturity level, your consciousness?
It's a good question. I think actually in the long run, I benefited socially and as a person from the fact that I had this additional year out before university.
Mm-hmm.
I got more out of university than I would have done if I had gone a year earlier. In other ways, I was pretty much already set on my path, not on a path to work in biology, specifically the biology of aging, but more generally in a path to dedicate my life to doing humanitarian things, to making a difference to the world. The particular way in which I had chosen to make a difference was by doing research in artificial intelligence, because a few years before that, when I was about 15, I had started trying my hand at programming, and I found I was damn good at it. So I thought, well, okay, what major problems in the world can be addressed by, writing software? And I realized that one of the biggest problems was the problem of work, the fact that most of us have to spend so much of our time doing stuff that we would not do unless we were being paid for it. And
right.
So that problem can, in principle, be addressed by automation. So I thought, okay, I'll work on automation, which basically means working on artificial intelligence. So when I did go to Cambridge, I did my degree in computer science. And after that, I worked in artificial intelligence research for several years.
All right. Well, let me just interject right in there because I want to understand. This has been, you were not just ahead of your time, but there was a very small group of people who were working very heavily in artificial intelligence at that time. And this was before the internet, so that you guys couldn't connect as far as easily sharing what's going on. How did you tap into the entire sphere of people around the world who were trying to study and understand all the challenges at that particular edge of the artificial intelligence movement?
Well, it certainly was different back then. And of course, you being 15 years older than me would have seen the same thing in your own world to an even greater extent.
I mean,
certainly back then, we used to go to actual libraries and read actual pieces of paper.
Actual paper? I've heard of these things called books and microfiche.
Yep, I use those. So actually, we were already emerging from that. So even though the web didn't exist in the form that we see it today, the internet did. The internet did already exist. And so, you know, I had an email address in 1982, and communication was not completely lacking. But certainly it was not the major way in which communication was done.
Sure. So how did you see, all right, so artificial intelligence as you were seeing it, so you were seeing the world. Now, can you compare what you had thought about and thought about artificial intelligence at that time and how you look at it today as we are looking, as we are actually seeing learning happening by machine learning, machines learning how to learn in 2020. Can you help us as lay people understand the difference and how that bridge has been happening?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's a huge thing that happened, and it really only started happening less than 10 years ago, which really completely shifted the emphasis in artificial intelligence R&D. So way back in the 50s and 60s, when artificial intelligence was a whole new thing, there were really two schools of thought for how we might eventually build machines that were smart enough to do most of the stuff that we don't want to be bothered doing.
Yes.
One of those approaches was essentially to emulate the structure of the brain, to take very small processing units, large numbers of them, and connect them together in a manner that would allow the communication to build up the performance of the thing, the function of the thing, as a kind of emergent phenomenon. And the other approach was not to do any of that, but rather to exploit the digital nature of computers and the mathematical nature of computer programming so as to formalize the process of artificial intelligence. That's what came to be called good old-fashioned AI, because it was really the mindset in which the whole concept of AI emerged in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
By the time I came along in the 80s, the idea of emulating the structure of the brain had pretty much been abandoned, because people had hit obstacles that they felt were completely insuperable and that this just was not going to happen. And they were making slow but steady progress on the other alternative, the formalized approach, the algebraic approach. And that's what I worked on. I worked on developing better performance at certain tasks within artificial intelligence. My main focus was on writing programs that would find mistakes in other programs. So that's a field called software verification. So that's what I did. And I made plenty of progress. I was pleased with how I was getting on. And I would have been, I think, perfectly successful in that area throughout my career if I had not chosen to switch careers and become a biologist.
Which is why, what impelled that? What was the shift?
Yeah, wait a minute. I want to finish answering your previous question.
thank you.
Because there's a very important thing that happened in the 2010s, in literally this past decade, that completely changed everything I just told you. Essentially, people discovered that so long as you worked on a very big scale, with a very, very large amount of data and very, very fast processors, you could actually overcome these obstacles that had been encountered, 40 or so years previously in the neural net approach, as it's called, emulating the structure of the brain. So now what we're seeing with all of the explosive advances in the performance of artificial intelligence, it's almost all based on that. On the rebirth of the neural net approach. And the approach that I was focusing on, the good old-fashioned AI algebraic approach, the formal approach, has been very nearly abandoned. So it's an enormous, enormous about-face that happened overnight, more or less, during the period roughly between 2012 and 2015, and that has just carried on burgeoning ever since. It probably won't be the whole answer. In the next decade or so, I expect to see the two approaches being, you know, interlaced to a greater extent, so as to get the best of both worlds. But it's been a very, very surprising and big change. Okay, so now let me go back to your next question, which is, how did I switch to biology?
What impelled you?
It all happened because I discovered that hardly anybody was working on the biology of aging. I had gone through my whole life until my late 20s, presuming that everyone understood that even though there were various bad problems in the world, including the problem of work that I just mentioned, nevertheless, there was one that was older above all the others, namely the problem of aging, which, you know, guarantees that you're going to get sick when you get old, which is kind of not good, really. So I thought, well, okay, this is so obvious that everyone's going to everyone's going to know this, and biologists are going to be getting on and doing their very best to develop ways to bring aging under medical control. And I never thought about it because I knew that, you know, I was a very good programmer, but I had no particular reason to think that I would be an exceptionally good biologist. And then when I was 26, I met and shortly afterwards married a biologist. And she's a lot older than me. We were married until only a few years ago, so for more than 25 years. She was already a full professor at UC San Diego, and she was actually in the UK on sabbatical. That's how we met. And through her, I accidentally learned a lot of biology over the dinner table, the way you do. But I also eventually began to realize that she wasn't interested in aging. And I started to ask about that, and it was basically that she just like felt it wasn't her problem, which I thought was crazy. And eventually I found that other biologists thought the same way. And the only reason I hadn't realized this before, and it wasn't just biologists, of course, I think most people think this way. The only reason I hadn't found this out before was because I'd never asked. I'd never done the experiment of actually discussing aging with anybody. So, when I did realize this, I thought, well, dear me, you know, even though, you know, I'm starting from not having any particular reason to believe I would be particularly good at this, I thought to myself, well, at least I know that I am capable of working on really hard problems, because by this point I had made quite a bit of a contribution to my work in artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, okay, I better switch fields, really. And by then, I happened to be in a very fortunate position where I could switch fields without risk. Essentially, I had taken a job at the University of Cambridge, which was very undemanding. It gave me lots and lots of spare time, as well as, of course, access to all these libraries and so on. And it paid the bills. So that meant that I was able to do my artificial intelligence research in my spare time. And I had been doing that for a couple of years by this point, because my source of funding that I had been funded by had dried up.
Yeah.
So you
basically did the same thing that Einstein did when he was the patent clerk. He was able to do his work very quickly and then spend the rest of his time musing and understanding special and general relativity.
That's right, exactly. I mean, of course, he didn't switch fields, but I did. All I had to do when I was switching research areas was to repurpose my spare time.
How wonderful. So then what happened?
Well, I started out, I got going quite quickly because I started going to conferences. You know, as I say, I had a job that was paying the bill, so I was able to pay my way to conferences and,
lovely,
you know, and learn a lot and obviously read a lot and get to know the top people in the field. And I had a few ideas quite quickly that were quite well received. So I became, you know, quite an integrated part of the community pretty quickly. So that was all great. And then in the year 2000, when I had been doing this for maybe about 5 years, I basically had a kind of eureka moment. I realized the big thing, the big concept that people in the field were missing in terms of the way in which we might actually develop medicine that would keep people healthy late in life. And I started to promote it, you know, to talk about it among my colleagues and to publish on it and so on. And it was a big departure from the conventional wisdom of the time. So it took quite a while to be accepted. And indeed, for the first few years, I encountered quite a lot of fairly aggressive opposition from my colleagues in the field. But over perhaps 10 years, and by, let's say, 2010, that was pretty much over. I had essentially explained myself and introduced the concept in sufficient detail to win them over, to win people over. And so since then, this whole way of looking at how to defeat aging has become completely mainstream and orthodox, and I don't have to explain it to gerontologists anymore. It's been kind of reinvented by other people in various different forms. It's the thing now.
That is amazing. How did you tell me about the eureka moment? So was this like a Watson and Crick moment when it finally all came together with the double helix, or was it a what was that? Because what I'm interested usually what I'm interested in is that not just the eureka moment, but I'm interested in what was it like the day before the eureka? What was it like 2 weeks before that laid the groundwork for that happening?
Yeah, okay. Well, it's kind of a bit like any inspiration in science. But you don't really have a groundwork thing. Essentially what happens is you've got this whole disjointed, fragmented collection of ideas and facts and knowledge and thoughts and opinions that the whole way that we have ideas, especially pioneering scientific ideas, is by those things suddenly just a jigsaw basically just solving itself, falling one down. This is the way that science works, really. And so in my case, as I said, I've been in the field for about 5 years, so I was pretty thoroughly immersed in what people knew, in what experiments people had done, and what results people had obtained. And I also was taking the trouble to read quite widely, in other words, to gain fairly in-depth knowledge about aspects of biology that most gerontologists would not have viewed as particularly relevant to their work. So I was going to a bunch of conferences outside of gerontology as well. And suddenly that all fell into place. It all happened actually in the middle of the night in Los Angeles. I was attending a workshop, a three-day workshop, was attempting to brainstorm and come up with new ideas for how to address aging. And the first day was a complete bust. I basically, I was very disappointed because nobody was actually coming up with any new idea. It was all, regurgitation of stuff that everyone already knew. So I was basically gagged because I had come from England, and I just was pacing up and down in the middle of the night, and it all came to me. And I got up early. I came down to the conference room early the following morning and wrote it all out on a kind of in a chart, on a flip chart, and presented it to everybody first thing on the second morning. And nobody understood a word that I said. It was my first attempt to get it across to people, and I'm sure I did it very badly, so I'm not blaming anybody else.
Of course.
Right. But anyway, over the next few months, obviously, I fleshed it out, and I actually ran my own workshop about 3 months later, in which I brought in half a dozen experts from various areas of the biology of aging, not to talk about their own work, but to essentially try to break my idea, to try to, show why my approach was not viable.
Absolutely. Destroy it in order to make it survivable.
That's right. And so the idea did survive that day. And so, of course, that led to us writing it up as a paper that has become the foundation of everything I've done since.
Aubrey, would you please explain it to me as a layperson and anyone who would be, how do you explain it in a way? Renee Jaworski, my producer, and I both listened to Alan Alda in Scientific American, how he interviews scientists. And that's the way I'm approaching you, from a place of deep ignorance. Yes, I am 71, so I have a skin in the game, sagging though it may be. But I do want to help me to understand and explain it in a way that I, as a non-scientist, could understand what the breakthrough is about.
Yeah, so this is actually one of those ideas that are really easy to explain to non-biologists, to non-specialists. So all I have to do as a starting point is to remind you of something you already know and your audience already know, namely that the human body is a machine. It's a really, really, really complicated machine, but it's still a machine. Its function is determined by its structure. In other words, the reason why the body doesn't work so well, both physically and mentally, late in life, is because there are differences in the composition of the body late in life that are getting in the way of function. Now, the question, of course, is where do those differences come from? And overwhelmingly, they arise as side effects of the body's normal operation. So again, we can look at an analogy with simple machines like cars or airplanes. We can say, well, okay, it is intrinsic in the function of a car that the car is going to accumulate rust slowly but surely. Fine. That eventually is going to impair the function of the car. The doors are going to fall off and so on.
Sure.
So then if we look at the human body, we can see a variety of different types of damage that the body does to itself during life at the molecular level and the cellular level. And indeed, by the time I was getting into the field, that characterization of what aging is, what these changes are, was already, you know, very established. In fact, no new type of damage had been discovered for nearly 20 years. And indeed, over the subsequent 20 years, again, no new type of damage has been discovered. So that's very good. We have good confidence that we do understand what aging is at the structural level, pretty comprehensively. All right, but then what's the big idea? What do we do about this? Now, the conventional wisdom and the way in which everybody in the field was looking at this, the idea of intervention in aging back then, was to try to make the body run more cleanly. In other words, generate damage more slowly than it normally would. Right? And of course, you know, there are ways to do that for cars. Indeed, there are ways to do that for living organisms.
Yeah.
But it's really, really, really difficult to slow down the rate at which damage is created, even a little bit, especially in long-lived like human beings.
Yes.
So almost no progress had been made in that over the decades prior to me coming along. And the big eureka moment that I had was to recognize that the goal here is to ensure that the amount of damage that the body is carrying around, the amount of this change that is self-inflicted by the body's normal operation, does not get to a level that causes an impairment of function. So think about that a little bit. So in a car, it starts accumulating rust from day one, but nothing happens to the function of the car until there is a certain amount of rust, a limited amount. It's fine. And it's exactly the same again for the human body. A limited amount of damage doesn't appreciably impact anything at all.
No.
So all we need to do is keep the amount of damage below that threshold. Now, if we're slowing down the rate at which damage is generated, then yeah, that's good. We would be able to delay the age at which the damage reaches that threshold and we start to get sick, right?
Yep.
Yeah. But there's another way. There's another way to achieve the same goal, which is to repair the damage, to actually eliminate the damage and restore the structure and composition of the machine, whether it's the body or the car, to how it was at an earlier age. And of course, with cars or airplanes or whatever, that's exactly what we do. The only
exactly, we restore them.
That's right. The only reason why we have vintage cars that are 100 years old or more is because those cars have benefited from comprehensive, periodic, preventative maintenance, which means
yes.
simply eliminating various types of pre-symptomatic damage, as we might call it, before that damage reaches the point where it is symptomatic, where things start to go wrong.
Exactly.
And so the idea is simply to do the same thing for the human body. And, you know, this sounds so obvious when I say it like this that you may have a next question of, you know, how come other people studying the biology of aging were not already thinking this way? And the fundamental
right.
answer to that is that they were not engineers, really. You know, they were thinking like biologists and
mm-hmm.
thinking, well, it's inherently more difficult to reverse damage accumulation than to retard it. They were just thinking, the way that they shouldn't be thinking. They were not thinking like
exactly.
engineers.
It was a mindset shift.
That's right, a real big paradigm shift. And of course, that's why it took a long time for my colleagues to really understand what I was saying at all. I guess I can feel, looking back, fairly happy that it only took about 10 years, because actually, by the standards of these things, that's pretty quick.
I should say so.
But yeah, here we are anyway. The past decade, you know, this has not been an issue.
That's wonderful. So, Aubrey, now in these last 12 minutes that you and I have on this particular conversation, where are we today? What are you taking? Who are you talking to? What is going on? What are some important points that we need to know that are happening today in your life?
Well, let me go through that in various, you know, facets. So first of all, in terms of the science, the human body, as I mentioned, is an incredibly complicated machine, and it accumulates
yes.
many different types of damage. We've got to eliminate them all because, you know, any one of them can kill you more or less on schedule on its own, however well we fix all the others.
Well,
so this
of course.
Approach, this damage repair approach is inherently a divide and conquer approach. We've got to develop a lot of different therapies that will be applied to the same people at the same time in
mm-hmm.
order to completely restore them and rejuvenate them. And some of those therapies are easier to develop than others. So at this point, we are already at the stage where some of those therapies are in clinical trials. They've got through the development phase in the laboratory and they're being tested on actual people. And quite a few more of these therapies will be in clinical trials this year or next year. So, you know, progress is really good. This is like way ahead of where we were even 5 years ago.
Goodness, Aubrey, that's wonderful.
And even the most difficult therapies, the ones that are at the earliest stage of development, I think they've got a good chance of being in clinical trials within at most 5 years, probably more like three.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all very heartening. There's a lot more to go after that. The thing about the human body being so complicated is that every aspect of the body talks to all the other aspects, which means that...
Absolutely.
Which means that these therapies are quite likely to interact as well. And we may have undesired, unwanted interactions. So it may take another while for us to get these therapies all working simultaneously in the same people.
Yep.
So I don't want to be too optimistic in terms of time frames, but all I can say is progress is pretty good right now. Now, to move on to another aspect of this, a kind of more societal one, one thing that has hugely improved the rate of progress in all of this is that a bunch of people in the private sector have started getting involved. In particular, investors, either wealthy investors who want to be, you know, invest
sure.
individually as angels, or for that matter, venture funds and so on. These people are beginning to realize that progress in the laboratory has advanced sufficiently to justify taking a risk. In other words,
right.
actually investing in startup companies. So over the past 4 or 5 years, that has been emerging as a hugely exponentially growing aspect of the field, and certainly an aspect of what I do.
Do investors come to you and say, who would you recommend that I back?
That's exactly what happens all the time. Because,
that is,
you know,
wonderful. That is wonderful. All right, here is one thing that I need your help with. We have 9 minutes left. We have 9,000 minutes, 9,000 minutes to a power great of conversation to have. And I'm going to want to have a deeper conversation with you. So help me to land this into what you want to say right now that will in some way be relevant. And then we put a pin in this conversation and then have a second one that can go deeper into all of these fields as we're doing, if you're willing to have one.
Sure, certainly I can do that. So the first thing I want to say, what your audience should be thinking right now is they should be thinking individually. You know, what can they do that they would want to do given the fact that this field exists and it's moving so fast? And that, of course, varies enormously from one person to the next, in terms of their age and therefore their chances of benefiting from these therapies when they come along. Also in terms of their situation. You know, if they are wealthy, then they can support this work financially and thereby accelerate it. If they are in the media, they can do what you're doing right now and help to get the message out to a wider audience and help people to think more correctly about it. If they're scientists, they can choose what areas of science to work in so as to have the greatest impact. You know, everything's different. And I want to emphasize the first of those things a little more strongly because, you know, a lot of people say to me, you know, how long do you want to live? Or are you doing this because you want to benefit your mother or your wife or whatever? Honestly, that's not the way I think about it. I think about it in terms of humanity. I think about it in terms of humanity in general, because
I'm no kidding. How could they know you? How could someone know you just as little as I know you and not know that?
Well, in fairness, the point, the issue here really is not so much knowing me. It's more a case of just doing the math, because what we are talking about here is hastening the elimination of aging as a medical problem. And that means saving a certain number of lives each day. But if you take each individual person, what it means is improving their probability of not dying of aging, right?
Yes.
Now, the thing is, each year that we hasten of aging is only like 1% increase in the chance of a particular person making the cut. You know, and it's a little bit difficult to get excited about 1%. But if you look at it in terms of
Global,
I don't know. I mean, the main thing is that
not for me. It's I know the laws of large numbers a tiny bit.
Well, sure, but I mean, the point is, if you look at it from the humanitarian perspective, it's much bigger because you know you've got maybe 40 million people dying of aging. Yeah, right. So you know that's like 10,000 World Trade Centers or something like that. It's like, it's quite easy to get out of bed for that. And, you know, any individual, if they give, you know, $100 to this thing, they're probably saving about 50 lives. You know, that's quite big. Except, of course, you don't know which lives because you don't know, you know, which where the cut is going to come, but it doesn't matter which lives.
No.
Right. So that's a big thing to think about from a personal perspective. The other thing the other pin I can put in the conversation is with regard to what people can do now for their own health. And this is actually a big issue because people ask me all the time, you know, what can I do now? And these things, as I mentioned, these are not yet available. Even the easiest things are still only at the level of human experimentation, clinical trials.
Of course.
So the things that do exist now that you can already buy, or, you know, things that are to do with diet and lifestyle, the problem is they don't actually do very much. And more than that, different people have different metabolisms and they will need different things to optimize how they're getting on. So in terms of specifics, I always say, well, there's really only one generalization one can make, which is pay attention to your own body and do what works for you. Don't just believe what some book says, because all books about this kind of thing are written for the lowest denominator, written for general. But beyond that, just remember that even if you get things exactly right based on what can exist now, the benefit that you will actually enjoy is very small. You know, a few months, maybe, if you're really lucky. And therefore, the main way that you can improve your own chances of making the cut, or indeed the chances of your loved ones, is by hastening the research in whatever way. And as I mentioned, depending on who you are, there are different ways.
Well, good. So let's put a pin in it there, because I have other question, because I'm not just interested in quantity, I'm interested in quality.
Okay, so let me stop you right there, because the fact is, a lot of people address that question wrongly, the idea of quality versus quantity. People are in a mindset of thinking that this is a trade-off between the two. And the reason they I'm not accusing you of this. I'm just saying, in my experience, a lot of people think this way. So that means a lot of your audience will think this way. And I'm talking to them, not you.
A lot,
yes. So here's what goes wrong. Today, when we can't do much about aging, it's a trade-off between quality and quantity. There are lots of things that people enjoy doing that shorten their lives. So it's a trade-off. But in terms of this medicine, it's not a trade-off. Quality is what is going to confer quantity. In other words, the only way that we're ever going to live longer is by living healthy longer.
Yes.
So people should not be thinking in terms of quality versus quantity, or one being more important than the other. They go together.
No, I misstated it to you. I misstated it. I meant the purpose of living. I meant people who feel purposeful with the time, that the extra time that they get, that they feel that we are actually purposeful. I mean, Aubrey, there's a home here in Austin of very wealthy people who are all in this wonderful apartment complex. They have extraordinary services. And it's one of the most miserable places as far as their consciousness about what they think about what they're doing on the planet, and feeling like that they have purpose. So that's the place that I want to talk about. And
let me spend a minute on that, because I think people are trying to make excuses for aging when they suggest that if we had a much longer life, then we wouldn't know what to do with it. And, you know, life would have some kind of diminution of quality. The way I think of it is this. First of all, take yourself back to the first time that you ever had sex.
Hold on right there. This is too wonderful. That's exactly the place where I want to pick it up again. We are at the end of our episode that we had, this first episode, and if you will give me the pleasure of picking it up right there, and we talk about how do we define purpose, I want to have that conversation with you.
All right, no problem.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Aubrey de Grey, and thank you for this opportunity to learn so much today. What a provocative, and we will see you next time. Bye, Audrey. Goodbye, audience. See you soon.